Welcome, everybody. Right now, we have on the phone Michael from our staff, and he's traveling, but is going to join and walk us through a bit any questions or comments on the merger report here in a little bit. Don should be joining us 10 to 15 minutes. He's on his way. And I don't know about anybody else, so we'll go ahead and get started. I want to start actually by introducing our latest summer intern, not quite summer anymore. I guess it's still summer. Morgan,
as long as it's hot as hell.
As long as it's hot.
In summer.
Morgan Garrels. Morgan's joining us from University of Chicago Law School for a while because of their notorious quarter system that they're on. So, you know, never quite synced up with anybody else, but we're happy to have her. Morgan, tell us, I don't know, a thing or two about your background. What would strike people as being, you know, notable?
Like, there's a lot of this, like...
You know, whatever you like. We get tired of the law every once in a while, so...
I'm kind of scared of birds.
Okay, there we go.
I'm kind of scared of birds.
Something
else?
Yeah. Well, it's a good conversation starter.
If I could only eat at one restaurant ever again, it'd be Taco Bell.
Oh,
and I'm unapologetic about that. It's
very good.
So good.
Very good. Morgan is from Iowa, and so, you know, I don't know how you put that together with Taco Bell.
And birds.
There, you know, yeah. Being from Nebraska, you know, myself. Mm-hmm. Fewer trees, maybe that has some assistance.
It's not like, it's like a mortal fear of birds. It's just what they bug me. Like, I don't know.
All right.
Sorry.
Good. Well, Morgan's, again, happy to have her. She's going to be a rising 2L and just working on a variety of projects for us for another couple weeks at least. what else to say? So, the reports on the agenda for today's discussion, the written comments are due September 14th, which is Friday of next week. After that, by the end of this month, you'll get a large set of draft recommendations, draft reports to review.
But you'll wait a day. Right.
We'll wait at least a day. In fact, it may be, yeah. Our aim is to be, we're still working on some
you
of this.
You submitted and then 5 o'clock you sent you new shit.
Yeah,
I
no,
hate that.
No. You might even
cruel.
have 2 weeks. We're aiming by the end of September. The next group of recommendations and reports is going to be on the sex offenses that are right now in Chapter 30. You know, there are a few other sex-related offenses scattered elsewhere, but really the Chapter 30 kind of core, you know, current sex abuse of a child, etc. That'll be one report. Human trafficking offenses, you know, somewhat related, stalking, and then a couple of general provision, kind of small matters as well. So, again, look for that by the end of this month. We'll give an extra long period of time for that large set of materials. but that's what's up next. Somebody reminded me this morning, a long time ago, I think we had calendared a potential meeting on September 19th. If you look... Good. It is not happening. So there was some discussion almost a year ago of this. So that is not happening. Just in case that somehow made it onto somebody's calendar, our next meeting is going to be. It is there.
That's interesting.
Yeah, there you go. So October 3rd, our normal first Wednesday of the month, will be our next meeting. Okay, so I'll send a reminder email about that as well. But yes, so normal Wednesday, 10 a.m. on October 3rd will be our next in-person meeting. And, you know, up for discussion will be this new set of reports, as well as the written comments we receive back on, shortly on, you know, disorderly conduct, rioting, et cetera, merger, et cetera. All right, any kind of organizational questions before we get started? And if not, what I'd like to do is actually move on to the merger recommendations first, since we have Michael on the phone. I think, Michael, can you hear us all right? Everything okay so far?
Yes, I can hear you perfectly. Can you hear me?
Yeah. I'll turn the speaker volume up a little bit. And just, you know, just open it up for any questions or comments you all want to have discussion about. We've had, I had at least one phone call from Laura. Dave, we had a meeting about to go over some stuff. So maybe people feel like they are just kind of writing up their comments at this point. But is there anything on the merger report and draft language that you all would like to raise? No.
So I'll just, I really don't, and I think I understand it. But look at the crowd we've got. We've got something to talk about. So one thing I thought was weird is that it's written as a presumption,
right.
And B is when it's not applicable, right? So I just...
Right.
Some judges are really smart and really good. Some aren't. I just sort of worried they'd be looking for how to rebut it or just say it's a presumption, I don't have to follow this. And I wondered about why it was written as a presumption. Yeah.
So just shall or something.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, so that was just intended to reflect the way that courts go about doing this analysis in the first place, which is to say that, you know, when legislative intent is clear, they follow it. And so this was just intended to be an expression of legislative intent, but the challenge is just that if it's not framed in terms of a presumption, then it kind of gets confusing where if you have this general merger statute, yet you have also a clear expression of legislative intent, like what you would do with that if it's not framed as a presumption, right? So just to be clear, in many cases, the CCPR, the revised code, will have offense-specific rules. Just at the beginning of sex offenses, or you know, whatever group we have them currently in, property offenses, that explicitly denote what is intended to merge. And so, like for example, in that situation, we wanted to be clear that you don't need to rely on these general merger principles. You just follow the explicit rule. But were the merger statute to be framed as an explicit rule also, then it just seems a little bit more confusing to have general merger principles framed as explicit rules, and then also these offense-specific merger rules as well. And so the question is, like, well, do they apply? How do they interact? So this just seemed like the clearest and sort of most transparent way to deal with that relationship, but you know, I mean, if people feel like framing it differently would be clear, we'd of course be happy to receive that in comments.
So, to follow up, when you use the word presumption, it sounds like somebody can overcome a presumption, but we're only in merger land in the first place if the legislature is unclear, right? Because that, I mean, B is actually the rule, right? You only get to questions of merger when the legislature is not clear, because they can create whatever they want to create. So I think I understand why the word presumption bothers you in
weird?
Two places.
Well,
yeah, as opposed to an affirmative statement of the law.
Right.
Yeah, so I just to maybe slightly rephrase kind of Michael's point, I think, is you know, this does run up against more specific merger type provisions in specific offenses. We recently did one in kidnapping, right? Pitched one where it's conduct incidental to, the commission of another offense, for instance, right? So,
this doesn't conflict with that.
So the question is just right: how to make sure that this doesn't conflict with that, and to communicate that clearly. And you know, another way to go, I suppose, is to kind of rely on the B, and maybe beef up the language even in B, to kind of really hammer that. This is more of a default rule, is another way to think about it, and it's talked about in the commentary, right? It's applicable except where a specific offense supersedes.
Yeah, but
so that so that's where we're intending. Whether the language of presumption gets us there, and the language in B gets us there, that I don't know.
You see, I read this to have a separate purpose. There are a bunch of clauses a bunch of provisions that I think we're going to be putting in there for the city council 10 years from now, when I won't be around, and a lot of us may not be around, and they don't follow the guidance that we're creating should they adopt the entire plan. So where the situation is that the code itself gives the merger priorities within the provision, that's for now. But to me, this provision is like, if the council should screw up and not specifically follow the plan later on, then this is the rule that goes into effect at that later time. So I think we have to be careful not to lose sight of that aspect of this rule.
Where the council doesn't say, this shall not merge with whatever. I don't know what they would say that it would be B, but it's just they make a new, stealing a car on Tuesdays, right? And so you're like, I wonder if that merges.
Carjacking.
Right. then we're going. So I felt like I got it. Like that was my first reaction was weird, presumption. All right, let me see how that's overcome. And then I read it and I thought, I see why they they use that language. I see what they're saying. Sort of, it's like presuming / assuming what the council's intent is, having not expressed to the contrary. But I still.
That's exactly right. Yeah.
But I read the whole. I read the whole thing. I just let's just have that on the record. But I was just sort of, and maybe eventually it just ends up being practice, and so nobody's actually reading the code. But I have a particular judge in mind, whose name I will not say because we don't share names here, who is going to say it's just a presumption. I don't have to follow that. And what does that mean for appeals or something? Of like, right? It's like having the voluntary guidelines. Like, thanks for the guidance, but it's just a presumption. I decided not to do it. It just feels a little more. I don't know if there's. I don't have a problem with the concept. And maybe it doesn't matter. Maybe I'm just being.
I was just going to say one thing to chime in.
So I mean I totally hear the point. It's a fair point. I just say that part, and this is another component of what we're doing, is we're trying to take the way that DC courts currently talk about this and carry that over, clarify that we're expanding it, we're expanding the scope of it, but it's still the same framework. And so when the DCCA or even the Supreme Court talks about Blockburger, this is the way they talk about it, as like in terms of how the analysis goes. It's like a part one. Here's the Blockburger analysis, and then comparing that, is there any other specific indication of legislative intent that either countervenes it or supports it? What we're doing is Blockburger is a part of this, but then we're going well beyond it, expanding, providing for a less formalistic, more proportionality based approach. But still trying to work within sort of basic dynamics of how merger how courts analyze merger problems. And so that was, in part, was to just try and pare that. That being said, you know, to get rid of the presumption language, and then either modify or move the subsection B, I think would be, you know, a easy fix and would, you know, would not significantly change anything. You know, this is just more of like a, what's going to be the clearest in terms of communication, because it sounds like everyone's on the same page in terms of the substantive policies. It's a question of what would most clearly communicate it.
I think part of it's too, because I consider presumptions like a starting point based on a very prima facie case that you make out. So if you're looking at
right.
And the attorneys can, the actual practicing attorneys can clarify on this, but I assume the way it works is you submit like a paper or a motion to the DCCA claiming that the two offenses merger, and in that you would say, here are, you know, I think it's the same course of conduct or one of the enumerated factors that go into the presumption of merger. And then at that point, there would be a response by the state saying, we don't think it falls in one of those categories, or there's a manifest legislative intent that they not merge. But that's just to get at the presumption that the judge operates from, so then he has to revisit, or she has to revisit the same question again for the final determination. And so I think that's the hard part with competing presumptions at that first stage.
Right. The one thing I will say is that there's a constitutional dimension here, which is to say that the Constitution does prohibit a state or federal court from ever imposing punishment, right, for multiple offenses that was not intended by the legislature. So that does, I think, add, you know, to talk about, because I think when you think of presumptions, perhaps in other contexts, you know, there's kind of like a more discretionary sense to it, but what we're talking about here is like the first of like what legislative intent is, and a court could like would never have the discretion to depart from legislative intent because double jeopardy clause prohibits them from doing it.
So then unless would map onto that, I think.
But if there are additional points, I think okay. This makes sense. I mean, I think. Without a real substantive difference, it would just require kind of tweaking the language a little bit. We'll double check that the language in B, is kind of clearly as clear as possible. But yes, rephrasing it not as a presumption, but simply a statement, you know, for the first line, it would simply be, you know, titled merger applicable instead of presumption of, and just instead of there is a presumption that. We just start capital M, yeah. Multiple convictions. And so we just like, we don't talk about it as the presumption. And I think that's a very straightforward fix that would address this like question, you know, right? And we can double check and we can make sure in the commentary it reflects, as Michael's saying, you know, again, often the discussion of this kind of thing is cast in terms of a presumption. But that's because often this is a third party or the courts, you know, trying to, in the absence of a legislative statement or statute, speak about this. So, great. I think that point is well taken. Other questions? And Michael, just so you know, Don and Renata have joined us as well. So we have close to a full house today. Other points on the merger report?
I have one on paragraph D. It talks about the most serious offense.
Wait, and where's D?
On the second priority. Page. I swear to God, I read the whole thing.
The next page.
Turn the page.
She said you read it.
And
this is something I brought up to you guys, but I'm not as familiar with all the adult sentencings as some of the people on this side of the table are. And I was wondering if there are any situations now where we have offenses that may be like, something's like a 20-year or 30-year offense, and you have another offense that is lesser time but has a mandatory minimum. And I didn't get a chance to research this, because then, if, and I don't even know if that's true, but if it is true, then I think we have an issue about seriousness because I think people might argue which is the more serious, the 30-year or 5 years in jail or 3 years in jail.
Or there's collateral consequences that matter seriously, matter significantly.
So I only bring that up to say I had more time to research since we met, I would have done that, but I didn't. So I just want to flag that if anybody can think of other examples of seriousness that may need to be worked into the equation.
Sure.
Do you mean anything other than basically statutory max? Were you thinking of it being, I don't know, something that gets discussed about what's more serious?
No, I mean, Dave has highlighted sort of like one ambiguity, right, in general, and I think this is going down, I think this has been addressed, one of the footnotes in the explanatory note. But, yeah, I mean, what we had in mind was higher statutory max, and, you know, we'll have a statutory grading scheme with even, like, with classification levels, so, you know, presumably those will all map on.
Yeah.
But, right, you know, Dave has identified a sort of gray area, which would be where one offense has a higher statutory max, but the other offense has a mandatory minimum, and, you know, how would you address that? That's something we will definitely address in the next draft.
Yeah, I think we do need to address it, and I think, you know, fines also, and again, however much things may be nice, kind of fairly clean, keeping classes now in what we put together 10 years from now, 20 years from now, who knows what other kinds of, again, so what we should do, I think, is clarify, at least in the commentary, what is meant by seriousness. Is it statutory maximum only? Is it other matters? Or, you know, leaving it open to question is another matter. I mean, look, we had the 2 months ago now, you know, the D.C. Court of Appeals opinion, right, on, it was an immigration case, right? Everybody's familiar on jury demandability, went en banc. And, you know, that was a really important decision because it looked to the specific facts of the case as to, you know, the effects on that person and their immigration status of the charge in determining whether or not it was a serious enough offense to be jury demandable. Now that, you know, again, nobody's that standard survives many places. Many by statute just make all criminal offenses, or at least criminal offenses with imprisonment time, jury demandable. But, you know, that constitutional rule is out there. It's it's a flexible one. So, you know, leaving this to a degree flexible as to what constitutes serious, you know, that is a route to go. It would be better if we could to clarify, right, does this include the collateral consequences for an individual accused, or is it simply statutory maxima? I think, again, we can research the question Dave had. You know, in practice now, are there places where there's a mandatory minimum that kicks in for yet a low statutory maximum, which is in tension with something with a higher statutory maximum but no mandatory? We can research that, but I think, and it may be, maybe there aren't any. It may be that this would work fine right now with respect to mandatory minima and statutory maxima, but it does beg the question down the road. So I think the question to you all is, like, you know, is there a clear answer to this? Because if not, you know, and if there are enough differences of opinion, and if we also want to keep it kind of, again, you know, go back with fresh eyes to the Beto or Bado opinion, the en banc one that just, you know, not too long ago, we could look at that with fresh eyes to see, again, what does that kind of discussion of seriousness, should that matter here for this type of merger rule? You know, this is a different context to talk about offense seriousness. So, thoughts from anybody about, like, what is a policy matter we should clarify in the commentary, or would it be better to leave it up to the courts?
This is a question for the practitioners as they're answering that one, too. I'd be curious what system you think
gives defendants notice as much ahead of time as possible as to what consequences they face if they're convicted. So to the extent, it sounds like the seriousness question would necessarily involve an individual determination on those facts, whereas more abstract principles would let a defendant know far ahead of time. So that's something I'm thinking about too. So if y'all have answers on that, it would be something I'm interested in hearing.
So I would just say that footnote 27 notes that the most serious offense will typically be the offense that is subject to the highest offense classification, but if two or more both subject to the same classification, then goes to separate maxima. So I think just in terms of like the fixed rules for the non-gray areas, it's a question of like which classification is higher. If they're the same classification, then you'd look at that for maxima. So that would kind of, I think, be the notice, at least in terms of this operation of this rule. And then after that is when the sort of the gray and uncertainty would come in.
Richard, with respect to the research question that you posed, one recurring example that comes to mind most immediately for me is if someone's charged with distribution or quid, and then also charged with possession of a firearm during a crime of violence. There you have a higher maximum with no minimum and a high maximum with a lower minimum. And that's a pretty common
combo. TFCVs, yeah.
That's a good example. The question, I guess, will be whether under what we put out, and though, right, as Dave pointed out, 10
which won't have any
road,
mandatories,
regardless of how we're setting the penalties, whatever the recommendations are for penalties now, the mandatory minima, I think we should be clear about the intended standard. Again, this footnote, it's now up on the screen. I apologize for the glare, it's hard to read, but maybe this is enough of puts the thumb mainly on, again, saying it's a matter of the offense classification. Maybe some different language. This may be something people want to think about some more and also include in any written comments. What would be the best way to kind of resolve this, or whether, I heard Kevin, saying, there's even tension in terms of, up front having a clear rule that everybody can predict about what's going to emerge as being a very important aspect of this. And that makes sense. And that is certainly doable for anything statutorily specified, the mandatory minimum, the fines, or maximum imprisonment. On the individual circumstances, though, and whether it is seriousness with respect to a particular defendant, that opens up another can of worms and doesn't give you the kind of predictability and foreseeability that,
It would, the idea is that would probably break, if it's going to deviate from the standard or break in the favor of the defendant, so that is at least, to the extent clear rules up front set a ceiling for criminal liability, that would be helpful. Just because I can, at that point, I know that the risks is going to fall one direction rather than both directions, and I have to make a more probabilistic determination there. But you see what I mean there?
Yeah, no, I think that's right. I don't know if there are particular, Katya Lord mentioned collateral consequences, but the other one that leaps to mind is, sex offense registration, right? A major, but again, I kind of can't imagine the case where something that is that you would have a registration eligible offense with a lower number than a higher number that is not registration eligible, and yet they would merge.
Your statute, you'd still have to register even if the burglary is the higher offense.
So
I don't know if that would be a driver, even though that's such a serious consequence.
Any other thoughts or discussion now? Or again, I just highlight this if people want to chime in any written comments, or again, folks, feel free to follow up with just a call or to us as well if you'd like. This is a good question, good point. Other thoughts or on this or other merger related questions for now? If not, I'm going to let Michael go off the phone, and we'll move on to the other.
How do we know Supreme Court nominee Kavanaugh will put the ACA?
Yeah, how do we know?
All right. Michael, thank you. I think we're going to move on to some other offenses. Take care.
Commercial break.
Yeah, bye.
Bye, Michael.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Bye,
Michael.
Bye.
All right. great. And you know what? It occurred to me just now, too, that it might be helpful for everybody to introduce themselves very quickly. Morgan, down at the end, those who kind of arrived a little bit late, we have a new summer intern, Morgan Garrels, down here at the end. She's joining us from the University of Chicago School of Law. Maybe just, Don, can you just kind of quickly introduce yourself?
Sure. Yeah. Professor of Law, GW, teacher from law events, and I'm at the lab at DC as a senior social scientist.
Hi, Dave Rosenthal with the Office of the Attorney General for DC.
Kevin Whitfield, I'm the policy advisor for the Committee on the Judiciary and Public Safety under the DC Council.
Laura Hankins, Public Defender Service. I've never eaten at a Taco Bell. Never. I'm going through life like that, too.
Katia Seminova, Public Defender Service.
I'm Paul Butler, Georgetown Law School. I teach criminal law and criminal procedure.
Renata Cooper. I'm with the U.S. Attorney's Office, and I serve as special counsel to the U.S. Attorney for Policy and Legislative Affairs.
Great. Excellent, thank you. And Paul, I don't know if you've ever met Kevin in person, but you guys should, if not, talk. Great. So moving forward, what else to say? Let's go to disorderly conduct and public nuisance next. So report 23, because the way things are kind of set up, the failure to disperse in rioting kind of piggyback off disorderly conduct. So let's go first to disorderly conduct. So this is, again, report 23. I'll pull the language up on the screen just a second. Great. Again, we've had some discussions with folks already, kind of individually, about the text and the commentary, but just want to open it up for questions and comments. I would suggest we start. We can do all disorderly conduct, but try to hold off on the public nuisance related issues until we do that next, once we kind of get through disorderly conduct. The only thing maybe I'd kind of say is general summary is that, right, compared to the current statute, so this takes the subsection 1 of the current disorderly conduct statute, and the other offense, what we call public nuisance later on, is addressing kind of the other parts of the current many of the other parts of the current disorderly conduct. So in terms of, mapping this to the current law, it's mapping onto, again, just the subsection 1 of the current disorderly conduct statute. And in, subsection A, thank you for the correction. And that really, even there, as the kind of commentary describes, it's condensing what right now is three subsections, the A1, A2, and A3. With that, just general opening. Questions and things to discuss with the group?
Yeah, let me start out with, I think we have a different reading of the legislative history on this. And I went back and sent you guys a follow-up email.
You bet.
My recollection from the hearings and from the letter that I wrote to Mr. Silbert at CCA was that, and then what I'm focusing on is the A1 paragraph B, that it's not directed on a law enforcement officer. In the current bill, I think in the current law, that is only the, I want to say, A3 provision that has law enforcement in it. I looked over the legislative history and I pulled up my stuff, and what I had said that was in its reference in here only dealt with A3. It never dealt with A1 and 2.
Sure.
And so I think that by adding law enforcement the way you have, you're expanding it in a way that is substantially different from current law, and in a way that I don't know that the council, well, I know that the council never considered doing. In other words, it's one thing, the A3 argument was law enforcement should be trained to have thick skins, so people directing abusive or offensive language at them, they should know better. Mm-hmm. But they should know better than to react, and therefore it's a less dangerous situation. But there was nothing in there that talked about them being the victim of an A1 or 2. Just what to that.
You bet. So let me maybe give a little bit of background quickly to kind of make sure everybody's kind of on the page. Again, we had some prior discussion with Dave about this. So the disorderly conduct statute, this all came out of a couple of years of work by the Council for Court Excellence, had a working group that put together a set of recommendations for the council. Prior to that, this was in 2009, probably, that started thereabouts. The council took those recommendations, followed many of the recommendations, but not all, and put out what we now have for the disorderly conduct statute. And there was particular concern about, again, at the time, reports of people being arrested and or convicted for disorderly conduct when they were words or conduct directed toward a law enforcement officer, right? So this was a significant subject, as I understand it, both at the CCE and the working group there, and then also at the council in particular. There was some back and forth. Dave was one of the folks testifying, and what they ended up was this. So what you see is that we have again, we're really concerned with the A1, 2, and 3. That's the other stuff, the B, we'll address separately. But for the A1, 2, 3, 3 is the only one that has this, in parenthesis, this caveat, this exception for liability, other than a law enforcement officer while acting in their official capacity. Now, this is the subsection 3, this is kind of the classic fighting words type of liability. And the question we hit in our analysis and concern is, does the A1, and it's not clear, by the way, that the council considered this or this was talked about this way, but at the time, if you have a situation where, again, an individual is being verbally abusive or doing conduct towards a law enforcement officer, while it is certainly possible to prosecute that under the A3, in which case that seems to exempt from liability, right? And the council had this rhetoric about, had the statement that, we think law enforcement officers should be held to a different standard. They have training. They're a different, set of concerns. This isn't disorderly conduct. And we can pull that up on the screen if we want. The question is whether that same conduct, and I, there's nothing we saw in the record that indicates this was even kind of considered, but that same sort of conduct addressed to a law enforcement officer could also be charged under A1 if the law enforcement officer feels that they are being threatened.
No, I actually disagree on a bunch of that.
Okay.
The Council for Court Excellence original recommendation actually only recommended law enforcement in A3. The letter that I sent on behalf of USAO and MPD and OAG only addressed A3 and was a slight variation on the wording of it to which the City Council objected. So I don't know that it is true that it was never discussed, and I think it was. And I think that, in fact, the difference is that the three are not mergeable, I think, in the way that you might be reading them. That the way Council for Excellence crafted it and the way the City Council adopted it, it is different depending upon who is the likely person to commit the harm that is being, that you're trying to prevent. So the A3, when it says other than a police officer, talks about in a manner that immediate physical retaliation or violence by that person, right, includes the that person. And the that person in 3 was the police officer. In 1 and 2, you're not talking about a violent reaction of that person. What you're talking about is a situation where somebody's maybe doing something which causes a third party to react in a certain way. So while I agree that 1 and 2 should not allow for the possibility of a law enforcement officer reacting that way, I don't actually think 1 and 2 was meant to include that anyhow. But that's different than saying that somebody can take, can act in a way aimed at a police officer that will not provoke a non-police officer into violence. And that's, I think, where our disagreement is about what was meant and what was covered.
Do you have the committee report?
Yes.
I've had it all.
Could I just address part of your point, Dave? So, first of all, I appreciate you sending me the additional comments and talking this through with me. There were sort of two aspects to what you pointed out. One was whether the legislative history was correctly reflected, and the other was whether this is expanding liability. And I don't know if we need to get to the first question, if we can address the second question, which is I think that one feature of the revised language is that because it doesn't differentiate between the kinds of conduct, right, it just says engages in any conduct, and then goes on to say is not directed at a law enforcement officer, I think the expansion of liability that you're concerned about might not exist.
Okay.
So the example that you gave me sort of offline was if someone is inciting violence toward a police officer. And that is, and I think you said, like if somebody said to a crowd, stone him or throw stones at the officer or something like that. In that instance, the conduct itself would be the speech, whether the speech is fighting words, whether the speech is incitement, however you characterize the speech, this is just conduct.
Mm-hmm.
And in that instance, that conduct is directed toward the crowd. It's not directed at the law enforcement officer. So I think it sort of gets around the concern you had about expanding liability to like people inciting violence against a police officer by people who are not the police officer, because that speech aspect of it becomes the conduct the way that the new statute is defined.
Hold on. I'm lost.
Sure.
One, Dave, I don't understand you to be concerned about expanding liability, but in fact, your concern is this is the more expansive liability, the current.
Terrible.
This narrows it.
That's right.
Okay.
Well, that's my fear, and she's saying no.
And then the example that you gave, hey, everybody, stone the police officer, under the proposal, that is directed towards law enforcement, right? You're not saying because I'm talking to the crowd that that's not directed to the, right?
That's how I read it, which is why I raised the question.
Right. So the revised statute just says recklessly engages in conduct. So whatever that conduct is, whether it's speech or other conduct, that's the conduct. And if a conduct is just speech, the speech has to be directed at the law enforcement officer to meet that exception. which I think is consistent with what
wait,
the counsel intended.
Wait, so if I'm not talking to the police officer?
That's right.
Right.
What?
And we can talk about this, you know, in other contexts later, but, you know, for instance, again, in a rioting type context, right, you have a crowd, somebody facing the crowd and says, you know, right, you know, it's soliciting a crime of violence also, but, you know, says, you know, attack, you know, you need to, you know, rise up and, you know, attack this police officer, right? Would that, now, there are various things, again, you might have solicitation of a crime of violence for that kind of liability. You might have rioting liability, depending on, you know, what's going on. I'll talk to that in a bit. But is that at root also, again, disorderly conduct in a way that wasn't the kind of thing that, again, directed at the police officer that was meant to be accepted from liability by the council? So that to me is the question, and I think as we had understood it in the commentary is, again, it needs to be directed at the law enforcement officer. If it's at others that is getting, again, essentially inciting others to attack, for instance, a law enforcement officer, that is not accepted.
And I don't mean to suggest that it's automatically disorderly conduct to make a statement like that to a crowd. It's still true that it has to cause somebody to reasonably believe that there's likely to be an immediate and unlawful bodily injury to the officer. So, for example, the Court of Appeals recently looked at this in the context of threats, right? If somebody is making threats at a police officer while they're handcuffed and being put, like, it might not be reasonable in every instance to believe that someone just saying that is actually going to cause that kind of a response. It's not an automatic disorderly conduct charge, but if somebody reasonably believed that that conduct, even if it's just speech, was going to cause that to happen, then it would amount to disorderly conduct.
Let me go back again. Renata asked to pull up, and I put it on the screen. Here's, as you all know, committee reports sometimes more or less sparse in their comments, but this is what we have for the committee summary, right, of this subsection A. We get this one paragraph, really. There are some other broad statements, but as to this point, this is what we've kind of got for the final committee report, at least. Again, it quickly kind of goes into talking about paragraph 3. It's talking specifically about, again, abusive or offensive language must focus on the likelihood of provoking violent reaction by persons other than a police officer. And again, it seems to be worried about, conduct to a police officers are not, they're trained, they shouldn't be provoked. Law should have a bright line. Offensive language directed at police officers, not disorderly conduct. And again, it's responding, at least in part, in this commentary section to some of the comments that have been received from, at that time, OAG.
I think the letter I wrote is on, I want to say page 86, mm-hmm. but I don't really remember.
Yeah.
Sometimes that stuff sticks, and it has the letter in it, and it only speaks to paragraph. In fact, it's titled, something like "Editing Paragraph 3"
I definitely hear you. You know, our reading too is that everybody was focused on paragraph 3 with regard to this matter, and if you're aware of any discussion about liability under A1, this is the hypo I would pose to OAG, is whether under A1. A law enforcement officer, we'll go back to the main language, in this situation, who feels that they are being threatened, they are in fear of their person or their property, is likely to be harmed or taken by the conduct or words of somebody before them. It seems like, while yes, that could that the current A1 on its face would seem to apply to that situation as well as A3. But, you know, our take was from reading the history, everybody was focused on A3, which is the most on point with that kind of hypo. But A1 would also cover that, and so really the exception in A3 should also cover A1 conduct. Now again, as Patrice kind of qualified, only when it's directed at the law enforcement officer. But so that's where we were coming from. It doesn't quite cut with where everybody else said.
Can we talk about what's actually proposed as opposed to inciting and provoking violence? That's not even here anymore. That language isn't here. I find disorderly conduct really hard and so problematic. I find this so troubling. But like how it maps on to A1 or A2 or A3, as opposed to a policy stop, a policy conversation about conduct, particular conduct, hypos or whatever you have in mind, and whether this language, I can't even like, I don't get that whole incitement thing. I find that incredibly troubling. But I also feel like, why am I trying to unpack that when I can't even find it in the language that's proposed? I don't know what it means. Who's the other person? What does that mean? It's not directed at law enforcement. So I say, Richard, you ought to stone the police officer. What's my conduct there? I'm talking, and because I'm not talking to the police officer, who's the other person? Who's alarmed? What? I don't get it.
Yeah.
But this seems to me, this is what we should be talking about, not whether it's A2 or A3. Fine. I can get on my phone and not.
So let me just say, like, right, I think it's important to...
Well, I only bring it up because the question is, are we expanding, are we keeping the same, and are we doing it intentionally? And right. Whereas I disagree with some of the commentary on it, I point that out. And so to get from where I'm coming from, if what you just said is it was the intent, I'm fine with that. I just think that the commentary needs to be cleaned up so that that is clear, as opposed to all the discussion that is in there about how it theoretically could have applied to the A1 and A2. Then my issue is not with the language, it's with the commentary is written.
Gotcha.
Just, you know, where I'm coming from.
Good. So I think there, like, I would say, I would agree with Laura's statement that, you know, this is difficult and confusing, right? And part of what I think is difficult and confusing is both the current language, current statute, and what CCE worked on, as well as this, it's trying to abstractly address a number of situations where there are different sets of actors with different perspectives, right? And I think maybe what would be helpful, and I think, you know, Laura kind of putting your finger on it to say, like, okay, from a policy point of view, you know, kind of stand back, what are we trying to cover here and what are we not, right? And I think maybe talking through a couple of hypos, right, of different situations might be helpful in that regard, right, as to, like, you know, and then we could talk about whether the language gets us there or not. Because, right, so, like, a basic encounter, I just put forward, you know, factual hypo, you know, punch bowls, just we're in a public place, say we're in a park, and let's start off maybe with three people being involved. There's a police officer who for whatever reason struck up a conversation with somebody there in the park.
Can we not have a police officer first? Can we just have civilians?
Okay.
Let's get the most basic.
Okay. Two citizens strolling in the park one day. And one of them begins to engage in some conduct that causes the other to reasonably believe there's likely to be immediate and unlawful injury. Not, let's say, bodily injury to another person. That's one hypo. Let's say that the person A starts to, like, just, like, swing
Rich, arm. Rich, I'm sorry to stop you in the middle, but
yeah.
There's one more another person that I need to understand,
yeah,
just to even follow your hypo.
Yeah.
So when it says causes and commits this, when that person directly engaged in conduct that causes another person to believe that there's likely immediate and unlawful bodily injury to another person.
Mm-hmm.
Are we talking three people there, or are we talking two? And I'm sorry for interrupting.
Yeah. Right, yeah.
But I need to understand that before I can follow
right.
the hypo. I read it as three people, not two.
Great, great.
Because it could be to
Absolutely.
That first
Absolutely.
Person, him or herself, or another person, unless, and I can't remember this, we defined another person, and that seems odd,
yeah.
to include the first party
right.
person and others.
And why isn't that
Great.
Something else?
Great.
Like,
so I'm taking away any, I'm putting Google
okay.
on the screen.
Okay,
Everybody
good.
Can look at Google.
Okay.
Okay, forget about revised language, current language, it's just this hypo, okay?
Okay.
So, two people in a park, walking down, no birds, no birds involved, two people in the park. One of them starts, you know, gesticulating and like jumping around in front of the other person, showing off, you know, it's like my son with his kung fu moves when he's like, you know, he's like, he's all over the place. And the other person's like worried that, you know, I'm doing my workout here in the park. I'm worried this, you know, this guy's gonna hurt me. But I'm not like, you know, I think something is likely to happen, but I'm not sure. Are we at all in disorderly conduct land? Should we be?
So wait.
Okay, let me just
say,
I agree
wait,
right
too,
now
yeah.
both with Dave and with Mara.
I think
okay.
they're disagreeing,
reasons.
But okay.
And there's, so first tricky. Of all, I think the hypos are difficult.
Yes.
And they will become more difficult because
yes.
I can say that there are several people, I'm certain, around this table that in today's context have some concerns about the perspective from which that harm
right.
and the nature of the conduct is viewed, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And so that's going to, and I think we have to do those hypos for sure. But I also agree that before we get down to the hypos, if we just look,
mm-hmm.
at the language that we currently have, and I agree, leaving out for now A3,
okay.
Which the council and
okay.
and in its report does seem to have been focused at least on A3. Can we focus on A1 and A2 as they currently exist to see if the new language even captures that? Because I think that's a simpler analysis. And in that analysis, you have to look at what does another person mean? Does it capture, as the current language seems to, this first person, as well as maybe it's somebody else they're concerned about, the property, and that is, we're not using harm. Now, if it's with respect to a person, it's bodily injury. With respect to property, it's correctly property damage. But that A2 talks about this other just inciting to violence generally, which does seem to be missing. So
yep.
I feel
can,
like
can we just do so
A1
looks the easiest.
Looks better.
Can you do it with just so you had two people walking through the park and then all of a sudden somebody was doing their little workout routine. We don't have two people. That was three people.
Can we start with
right.
a hypo?
I like that hypo. I just want to know whether
a protest and one says to the other, let's pull down this lamp this sign and smash in Bank of America's window, right? One of them is trying to incite others into some type of conduct, right?
But see,
no, I don't want to incite yet. I like
down.
The person who was acting up in the park.
Can
we act up
right,
in the park?
This is why I want to start with the easy one, right? Like,
yeah. Now, hold on.
If you go from easy to hard,
yeah,
okay.
So guys,
if you start at the hardest one,
I know.
Then
let's
you're,
just decriminalize
so,
that. That'd be easy.
Yeah. So I yes, thank you all. So I think there's enough fundamental differences of opinion as to both the current statute and the revised statute that I again, as difficult as it is, I do think trying to talk through some hypos rather than the language is going to be the most helpful because. If we can't agree, and I think we can't, as to the meaning of the current statute or the revised statute right now, I think go back to like surveying or at least getting a straw poll for what people think about particular hypos.
So why can't we start from, I mean, it's pretty obvious. A1 is talking about...
So give us the hypo.
Well, Renata, the different the hypos in my mind is what I'm saying.
What's your hypo?
You're
what's your
Don? I mean,
Don thought he had an easy one. I just when so, we get the I just want to get to the police officer.
So A1 to me does sound like the example, the hypo that Richard is so desperately trying to get out, and that is that you have someone who is behaving like his son, sometimes behaves simply in the son's own mind, just testing out and doing his. Taekwondo moves,
yep.
And you have you are there, and another person is there, and maybe there's a total of four people because the person approaching has someone with them.
No,
now go on.
No, wait. All so right. That's my wait. So there's the person who's being doing their supposed Taekwondo routine. Can there be just one other person in the park who's like? If that guy swings that whatever, I'm going to get hurt.
Right, is that nonchalant?
It's it. It's just me. It's just
a
me.
Whiteboard over here. Pull over the whiteboard. Let's see if this will help maybe a bit. But I do think like...
Am I allowed to be harmed? Am I allowed to be alarmed? I'm the person who might get hurt. Bam, disorderly.
That's right.
Reasonable fear, though.
Okay.
Okay,
so we got,
well, he's such a crazer.
Person A is the one who's engaged in the... conduct / speech that's complicated already.
Okay.
But, okay.
Picture a young boy shouting, I'm going to karate chop you.
Right.
Right. Exactly. Yes. person B is the, we'll call them the bystander. Okay. Start with this kind of basic, and we're in a park. We're in a public, well, we're just going to put that aside for now. We're in a public place. Okay. Great. Intuitions at this point. Should this be disorderly conduct when the conduct at issue is the kind of boy jumping over doing crazy moves right in the path, shall we say, of the bystander who's approaching. Is this disorderly conduct? And I guess, you know, also, if you want to, you could look at the current law. It's not going to be fighting words of the A3 version.
This is an A1.
So it's A1, if anything.
Is it
A1 under current law? And then we can kind of say, should it be, right? So again, recklessly acting in a manner as to cause another person, the bystander, to be in reasonable fear that a person or property in a person's immediate possession is likely to be harmed or taken. It seems expansive enough, right? The a persons are really unclear as to could be anybody. One thing we mentioned in the report is person A is doing something that almost seems like self-harmish, right? Like they're jumping on top of the, you know, I've seen this from my son too, you know, I'm gonna stand on top of the, you know, picnic bench and do just like crazy jumps, right? You know, because that's fun. A witness seeing that, the bystander coming upon that, it has at that point disorderly conduct under A1 transpired. If they got on the phone, they yelled out to the police officer, far distant, not right on the scene, could they report that and it would be perfect?
Our person is supposed to be under the original language, which is all sort of spread out.
Uh-huh.
What they really are supposed to be is a reasonable person. So a person has to have reasonable fear because they are a reasonable person. So if they are far away from that person who's got nunchucks, and they're doing like this.
Uh-huh, uh-huh.
And even if they fly out of the person's hand, if it is not reasonable for you, even if you're in an apartment building looking through binoculars, to believe, given what you can see on the ground, that anyone would suffer bodily injury, then that's not reasonable, and there is not disorderly conduct.
So the reasonableness is a great qualification on the conduct or speech has to be of a sufficient degree that it would cause a reasonable person
To believe that bodily injury could result to some person.
That's right. It's even likely, right? Like, it's a fairly high standard here, so is what I kind of hear you saying, right? So it has to be,
reasonable to believe that bodily injury to someone is likely. And I'm saying someone just to get around the...
And not the person who's behaving that way. No.
Well, that's...
No.
Okay. Let me just say...
Hold on. Yep.
On Laura's point,
yep.
I am unaware of OAG ever prosecuting a two-person disorder. So...
But I'm positing a one-person disorderly. You're not doing that either. That's not a crime.
I don't really understand.
You mean this type of...
It at least has to have two people.
No. I just mean the person who thinks they might get... It's not me going right to... So that kid is... That's way too high. He should not be jumping off of that brick wall. I am far away, and I'm like, oh, my God, he might hurt himself.
No, that's not disorderly.
So it's not that. That's what I said. It's not the person who's doing it might harm themselves off the table.
That's right.
Now there's one other person present, the bystander, who's like, oh, my gosh, the nunchucks might hit me.
And I said that I'm unaware of OAG of charging a two-person one situation.
Right.
Can I point something out about that, though? So this isn't just replacing A, 1, 2, and 3. It's also replacing a phrase. And a phrase
Great point. Let's hold on to that.
We got to get through A1 and 2 first.
I understand, but I'm just pointing that out because it changes the way you think about the two-person disorderly. You might not charge two-person disorderly right now, but you are charging a phrase, and that's being replaced by this.
Well, okay. Good. Good point to know. Bookmark. Charging, yes.
A-F-F-R-E-S.
I'm sorry.
A lot of phrases. I'm so stubborn. The vowels got to be really hard.
Dave, would you also venture to say, I don't know if this is going on a limb for you or not, but that an arrests have not been made in a two-person situation?
Again, I can't speak for OHA at this point, or MPD, but I am unaware of even arrests having been taken place in a two-person disorderly. So, in fact, even three is pretty rare. But
so in the hypothetical that you mentioned with the guy who's making weird gestures, to another person, so MPD wouldn't intervene in that situation?
I'm not saying that they wouldn't intervene, but that might be an attemptable assault. It might be something. I have not seen them arrest. All I'm saying is my experience. I've not seen them arrest on a disorderly charge that situation.
What's weird about it, slow down, what's weird about it is the reason why MPD is there arresting is they're the third person. Right? But to think that bystander... No, hold on. It would be weird for bystander to be like, I'm standing here, and if this person swings one more time, I might get hurt. I'm scared. Right? That by the time the police show up, they can be... That's where we started. They could potentially be the observing third person who's like, oh my gosh, bystander might get hurt. But if it's just the bystander and one other person... Then it's always like, do you call the police afterwards? I'm safe now, but that shit was scary 20 minutes ago. Who's arresting on that? You seem fine.
Yeah. So I will back up a little bit.
It was more serious than it was assault or something. Yeah, or it's something.
But although in the more typical situation, that I've seen, the cop may come on the scene, but there are more than two people there. There's a group of people there, and the situation is that the behavior is aimed at one or a few of them, and it's the rest of the people that are in reasonable fear that person's going to be hurt. Not necessarily a cop who happens to be there.
Right.
The cop may come on the scene after this yeah. fall is
so, so this simple situation, relatively simple, is I hear you saying, is anybody saying that this should be criminal conduct, a two-person situation? I hear you saying, Dave, would OAG say that it is within the scope of the current offense or should be of the revised offense for this kind of two-person situation?
I haven't gotten instructions on this point, so I can only speak for myself.
Okay.
And OAG may chime in differently later on, but I don't believe that's the sort of one.
Okay. Well, that's helpful.
A two-person
situation. I just can't even understand why the focus is on number. Because I wouldn't even call B bystander.
Yeah.
I would call B observer.
Okay.
Because
yeah.
that person would be so...
Could be on the apartment building with, next door with the binoculars, sees something in the park. I mean, the distance... I think let's keep moving through a couple of these, maybe, and I think this is going to help a bit to at least narrow and direct
and,
our differences.
Let me tell you, the reason that I think observer is important is... It's this, and what I know that we are concerned about. Observer, you know, private citizen, you know, in a high level in an apartment who is not going to be harmed in any way, and maybe even police who then are called for whatever reason and they arrive on the scene. They're not going to be harmed, and again, there's still no one else around. So sometimes people call the police because they're crazy, and they got other issues. And sometimes people call the police because you see that guy in the corner with the nunchucks, and you're thinking, I'm okay. School's out, so normally at corner where these kids are walking to that school, they're not there. But what if some other clueless person comes walking up the street, could be Richard, and you see them at a distance, and none of this is reasonably likely to cause him bodily injury. People call the police because they want to say, like, ooh, I'm not in a position to go out there, but maybe somebody would say, hey, fella, think about what you're doing. Mm-hmm. You know, maybe go somewhere else with your nunchucks and where it's more safe. So, again... I'm really, really focused on police action having to have this reasonable belief that someone's going to incur bodily injury.
Right.
And I'm not focused at all on numbers of people around.
Great. So well, and to that extent, in this situation, if the bystander, if A is causing B to have a reasonable belief that they themselves, right, are going to, like, you know, again, guy jumps out in front, is doing his crazy moves. If that person B reasonably thinks, and as in a later, you know, seemed to reasonably believe that he was likely to be hit, let's say, and let's say not, you know, he takes off running, reports this. What that encounter was that criminal? Was that a criminal instance of disorderly conduct? It sounds like, if you're not, right, like, we don't care about the numbers, then, like, if B really thinks that, like, and reasonably thinks that he got out of there just as it was likely that there was going to be, he was going to be assaulted. Now, again, you kind of mentioned before, you know, like, attempted simple assault is always out there. Now, again, attempts, you have to be, you know, dangerously close. You know, like, okay, maybe that line isn't exactly where, but how is that really different from, you know, somebody who's flailing their arms, you know, in the vicinity? What is going to be likely to make you think you as a bystander were going to be hit that wouldn't also constitute attempted simple assault? It's not clear there's much room between those two. But yeah, I don't know. We're not, it's your sense, like, if the bystander really believed this, they, you know, reasonably believed that they were about, it was likely that they were going to be hurt from this behavior, this a person. I don't know. Maybe? Criminally liable.
Again, it's always reasonable. It's what we see with law enforcement. Sometimes you put yourself in a place where you limit your options simply by proximity.
Yeah.
And that is for civilians, law enforcement, everybody. So, I don't know.
Okay. Yeah, no, no, that's fair.
If the person's on the corner and I can go to the other side of the street, I don't think that's disorderly conduct.
Gotcha. Yeah. Right, because, good. Okay, so it gets into us various fact-specific inquiries, what I kind of hear about, like, look, was it really, like, it was an open park. I could walk this way. I can run. That it seems distracting. You know, maybe we could set up a fact scenario in a limited tunnel, you know, can't get away, confined space, or in an elevator or something.
All
right?
Of those things matter, because we've already taken it from just the person flinging their body around to a person having something attached to them that can also, it has some length on it, or it can even get distance if it's thrown out. So,
So
it's factually based.
Right.
It's what a reasonable person would believe could cause harm.
But it sounds like at least potentially, there's you would find liability in this situation. Potentially, depending on the facts. Okay. Let's add in the observer. So, an observer C. An observer C, and I'm going to say, to distinguish these...
Can I rename them? Engage. The person engaged.
Engage for
the
B.
Target is B, and C is the observer. In other words, the action is aimed at B, and C is the observer of what A is doing.
And
aimed at. See, I don't like target.
Because I think you've got observers, you know, like into the and whatever, to infinity. Because that is always the question, target.
Okay, I think what you're getting at, though, is
the receiver. It's reckless. It's not necessarily aimed at.
Right. I was going
physical proximity. They're the person close by, right? They're the person who might.
They're the person who who you're afraid is being
The person who might receive the injury.
Yeah. Okay, receiver is fine.
And then C
is observer.
Observer. Okay, great.
That would be the next, I think, level up.
Okay. Now in this case, let's say. Let's at least start with saying the person who's having the reasonable person here is the observer.
Mm-hmm.
It's their judgment that's going on about they're the reasonable person. They're judging this encounter. Maybe it's the student getting out after school, walking down the path. B's walking down the path toward A, who's doing the crazy moves, and C is person a little ways off, sitting on a park bench, watching this. Seeing, you know, what they think is going to be an encounter here. Again, facts really, really matter. But if the C reasonably thinks it's likely that the person walking, you know, now very close to A is going to get injured, is that disorderly conduct?
I think it is both under your proposal and under A1.
I have a brief question on how reasonableness works in this context, really quickly, which is, do we think that uncertainty is going to justify a fear or undermine it? Which is to say, precisely because I'm an observer, I'm not armed with the full facts of the situation, I don't know there's a karate class that's doing a sparring in casual clothes, is my fear bolstered by that uncertainty, or is it reduced by that uncertainty? Because I think at that point, the concern here is going to be we are exploding liability to like the physical proximity with which I can exert a reasonable fear if not understanding the full factual situation doesn't undermine that fear. That's just a huge concern.
I think to that though,
they use the word fear. It uses the word belief.
Reasonable.
Right, but that's the same. But
I think to go to your point. I think the officer might have probable cause to arrest if they don't know there's a karate class going on. But I don't think OAG could prosecute it if it was a karate class going on, because then we're looking at we're not looking at it from the perspective of the police officer on the scene, but at the facts of what really happened.
So well, I don't think that's the
But you could come up with a million hypos where a cop has probable cause and he's been arrested, but that doesn't mean they end up being guilty.
The problem is this, though, is that
probable cause. And it's not, and again, because I was going to say to you, you want to say it's the observer. Yeah, that's fine. They think that. I don't care what they think. But what's important to me is what law enforcement, how they view it with those facts once they are on the scene, whether they have probable cause to arrest.
Right. Well, and this kind of, again, goes, you know, the reasonable person standard is, if anything, it's an objective standard, right? Like, it may be tailored in some sense to what's known to people, and this is where there are still difficulties about, did I know it was a karate class that was going on, or did I not? The reasonable person with what set of facts? But it's not the actual person. This does require some, at least the current statute and a revised, requires some sense of objective assessment of reasonableness.
But it's still, what's the answer to what Kevin was saying? Like, that's a really, he's in the park, and he sees it. He has a belief
yeah.
that receiver is about to be
yeah.
harmed.
Yeah.
And
Unlawfully.
Yeah.
But limited facts.
That's right.
But based on his limited facts, what he observed, is that it? Is that the truth wins in the end? Where A says, once you intervene, or something, A says, no, this is a sparring class. We're practicing our circus act. Whatever.
Yep.
Actually, the circus act better, but does that work? Sorry you were alarmed. You totally didn't get what was going on. I get, based on what you thought, that seemed reasonable, but
I think part of it's because we've moved.
And anyone, objectively, with your set of facts, would have been alarmed. You're just wrong about what the truth is.
And I think
that works.
This
generally how we apply, I don't know if we've clarified it.
I understand why that sounds strange, but it does center on the idea of public alarm and not the actual harm.
So that's a crime?
So if the person reasonably believes that it's likely that there's going to be an immediate unlawful harm, right? It has to be reasonable.
It is. It looks like there's about to be like serious karate.
Well, I'm actually seeing a fight.
Right.
Like it's a mixed martial art, it's a brawl.
Yeah.
So it looks bad.
So that
amounts to disorderly conduct.
Yeah,
even
I mean
if it's
I mean, imagine if we all have guns loaded with blanks and are shooting at one another.
That they're going to promote,
you know, could that be disorderly conduct, right?
Among reasonable people,
if we're not allowed to do that,
right?
So let me back up. Right. The person who's engaging in the contact has to be conscious of the risk that they're going to provoke reasonable people to have this reaction, right? So it's not just.
Well, just really quickly. The public alarm, that's a new articulated harm. Because when I think of public disorderly conduct, I'm thinking about fighting words and incitement. So I think that part, because then here's the question. Should we be criminalizing public alarm for lawful activity? And I don't, that's like a really, I don't know.
Well, Richard went right there with the hardest possible hypothetical.
I think that's a great question, and I think the answer is under current law, yes. From our point of view, and our reading of the current statute, and look, I will say this, and the council said, right, in this disorderly conduct report, they're like, look, this is hard because it's at the line between criminal and non-criminal. It's at the line with First Amendment protections, and you're stepping outside. So it's very hard, but look, at least the current Chapter 13, it includes a lot of stuff, right? It includes, and a lot of it's very old, a lot of it's very minor in the sense of being misdemeanors, but it really raises these questions. Is throwing an object, right? I think playing in the streets, isn't that in right now 13? There's in the end, there's a lot of, and this is old, not, we could recommend to change it, But right, the old notion here was that a breach of peace required some kind of a serious disruption of public order in this broad sense, and maybe that's acceptable, maybe it isn't. But that's the line we're flirting with, and it does seem like the disorderly conduct captures, at least on its face now, this. Maybe it shouldn't. I will say this, on the First Amendment issue, while you can look at the current statute and you can say B is a kind of an incitement, which is a well-recognized kind of exception to First Amendment protection, and C, fighting words, the A1, I'm sorry, 2, 3, not C, B and C, but the A1 is very much a bit of a novelty, right? It's a hybrid that's doing a number of things. There is, again, kind of a First Amendment exception for some types of conduct that make a person, again, think there's likely to be an imminent harm of some sort. But this is tough stuff. So so the Observer, go back to this. I'm not hearing much difference in terms of whether it was B perceiving that they were the one, whether it was the arrow here, they were the one in whose judgment reasonable person, they reasonably believed that they were likely to be hurt, versus somebody else witnessing and seeing they think that B is likely to be hurt. It sounds like the alarm that suffered, whether it's by B or C, that alarm, that panic, that is arguably the disruption of public order that's being attacked under either one.
Chapter 13 is called Disturbances of the Public Peace. That is where it all originally started.
Absolutely.
From.
I think it's helpful to look at that wider view for a second, because these are different than the other offenses for that reason, right? These breach of peace statutes are aimed at something else. The idea is, at what line do we want to authorize law enforcement to intervene so that people do not become so alarmed that they resort to
arrest
and
prosecute.
Let me finish, Laura. That they intervene before someone is so alarmed that they resort to violent self-help. That's the idea, right?
Sure.
So when we're looking at disorderly conduct and a phrase together, and we've combined them in this way that we're talking about all kinds of conduct, not just speech, but also the sort of mutual combat, other things that don't amount to another kind of an offense, we're figuring out where that floor is for law enforcement to be able to intervene and where a conviction would stand, right? So your hypothetical that you've offered about someone as a joke or as a hoax or through some sort of like mutual agreement decides to go outside and do something where either they know nobody is going to get hurt or everybody's decided that we want to fight each other may very well amount to a breach of peace. It might not amount to an assault, but it might reach the floor of breaching the peace, and it's a much higher floor than the common law breach of peace statutes, which is if you've disturbed the king's peace, then you go to jail. It's not nearly that low, but it is going to be lower than what you're looking for to sustain an assault charge, because the social harm is something very different than what you might have been conceptualizing before. These are breach of peace statutes, just like it is in every other jurisdiction. That's what disorderly conduct is.
Yeah, and I would put out there too, again, before he said simple assault, I think we're kind of, maybe what leapt to my mind, what was in my mind was a battery type assault. But we also have a menacing type assault, right? Liability, which is also out there, which again is just a reasonable, apprehension of fear.
But
again,
the attempt does require the intent to cause that prohibited result.
Attempt,
so it
right.
may not,
in this
disorderly cases may not require, may
in
not
this
involve
point,
an actual
just
attempt.
A plain menace. Maybe what's sufficient, right? I think it's important in all of us to think about what other ways, right, there might be liability, because they question, do we need this? Does this, what work is this whole regime doing when there's this other stuff out there? I wanna add in, crazy as this is, so whether there's C, whether there's DEF, right? Number of people. The core harm that still is going on is B, through whoever it is, has this apprehension, and that is a disturbance of, and it's based, but I think Don's point is important too. As we've drafted, at least clarified, there's a reckless mental state for the person engaged in this, right? So the person who is absolutely clueless, right, about doing their moves, they think they're alone in the park, right? They don't know somebody's, like, right coming up behind them. They would not be liable, right? They don't believe, the language we have, sorry, I can't put another thing up on the screen without making that so small, but so the proposed language, recklessly engages in conduct that causes. Were they reckless as to causing another person to believe? Were they subjectively aware, right, of a substantial and unjustifiable risk that somebody else is going to see what they're doing and be, just believe that there's likely to be this harm? And one way around this, and this kind of goes to Dave's point too, about if the person had a sign out, right, in front of their, this is Taekwondo demonstration at 10 a.m., and they're doing these moves out there, and it's right next to the path, and, B is jogging down the path about to come up near this. C, the observer didn't see that sign. Maybe B didn't see the sign. Maybe one of them did, the other one didn't. In any case, we have this tension now. Okay, was A reckless about this? Probably not, because they think they put up a sign. They weren't being reckless as to causing somebody this public disturbance. So I guess that mental state and requiring at least some subjective awareness from the recklessness puts keeps the conduct from spilling over into all sorts of stuff.
Recklessness also requires a gross deviation from the ordinary standard of care. So if we're doing some kind of demonstration in a park that is sort of within the ordinary standard of care, then that person would still be exempt from liability.
Right.
So I think I got a clear sense of it when you mentioned the violent self-help. So I think the tension is that it is very unlikely, it seems to me with the examples we have so far, that the observer is going to be engaged, is going to be encouraged to engage in violent self-help. And it's cut against the further away from the action they are. So if I'm rear-windowing, across the street and I see some violent conduct, well, I'm not going to leave my apartment building, walk across the street, and then engage self-help. I'm going to call the cops, which is, I think, for starters, the response we're trying to encourage somewhat with these offenses. So I think we have a couple different harms then. We have person-to-person, sort of like this, the public alarm. You have fighting words, and you have generalized incitement as a sort of, a package of pre-rioting offenses. And I just think that the people who can be triggered by the first category is broad, considered the harm, which is we're trying to prevent violent self-help. A casual observer is probably the least likely person. It's going to be the target that engages in violent self-help.
No, except there was a court of appeals decision, I want to say in the last 3 years, about an old woman on a bus, if I remember the name of the company, and these kids were harassing the old lady. Other passengers called the police because there were people on the bus that were going to stick up for the old lady.
But they're in a bus together.
Yes. So I'm just giving an example of when they interviewed the woman, she actually said, I didn't think they were going to hurt me.
Okay.
But the Court of Appeals agreed that was disorderly because, and that's what I'm saying, to go back to what you were saying, because the, notwithstanding that in this example, B didn't think they would be hurt, C's were the people who were likely to break out in violence, and that was good enough for the Court of Appeals.
And was their conduct, absent the creation of fear in other parties, already unlawful? would have been? Was there another criminal offense they could have already targeted those folks with?
I don't recall it. This was a disorderly case, and I don't know if that was argued.
Because that's the other thing, too, is that...
What else
but that's a really good example, because I can imagine that, and I don't want the old lady to be scared. I also can understand being the person on the bus who's like, oh my gosh, that poor old lady. So what do we want to happen? So I want to be able to call the police, but it's going to take them 5 minutes to respond, right? I'm either saying like, I'm calling the police, you stop that, you kids. Or it's going on for 5 minutes. But to me, then it's a question of, did a crime happen? Like, I would like the police to show up and be like, kids, bad idea. Like, don't do that. That's really scary. But like, arrest and prosecute? It's over.
But it wasn't over when the police got there.
I think the instinct that you're having has been addressed a lot of different ways in a lot of jurisdictions. D.C. is... unusual in how it sort of deals with low-level conduct. The idea that every single person is booked and arrested and like actually removed as opposed to having citation in lieu of arrest procedures and like sort of warning systems and having a misdemeanor on the books if an officer doesn't make an arrest makes sort of like the way that police interact in these low-level situations different than the way other jurisdictions deal with this. There are some jurisdictions that have statutes that even say, instead of outlining this is what the criminal offense is, here are the times that the police can put somebody in handcuffs, even if it's not a criminal offense. And we don't have that right now. We don't have, like, here are a list of things that aren't even criminal that we're going to allow the police to temporarily detain people for. We have as the floor, you need reasonable articulable suspicion that there is something criminal in the District of Columbia before you can do this. So it's a different kind of an approach that other people have selected as options, but that's really not the framework that DC has ever had, and it would require quite a bit of overhaul to say, look, the problem here is we don't want somebody to actually have a conviction for something that we think is really minor. Other places have de minimis provisions. Other places do a lot of things to sort of make sure that this lower level stuff post and forfeit is one such mechanism that the district uses.
But MPD will tell you they don't want to be put in a position of intervening if there's no crime to which they can make an arrest for. In other words, you can't set up MPD to say, go in there and tell this kid stop bothering the people on the bus if MPD can't arrest if the person continues. Yeah. To do that.
I think everybody, you know, again, and this is definitely an issue, right? Like, these are rules, again, because they're at that borderline between criminal and non-criminal, the greater clarity we can give, the better, right? For MPD, for everybody to know, but it's just really hard. Renata was kind of emphasizing the facts really just matter so much that it's hard to articulate general rules about this. Again, as Patrice is saying, a lot of jurisdictions do this. They go into like kind of more detailed regs, but the way we've kind of set it up in the district, like this is the bottom level, right? This is kind of as minimal as it gets. And besides this, yeah. Now it's a separate question too about penalties, right? One of the classes that we've proposed is a no imprisonment. Lowest level, what in many jurisdictions would be called an infraction, or but you could say there's no imprisonment time, but it's going to be, you can get arrested for it. It will create a record, and all the things that then come with that. So it's a hard call, I think, on these issues, whether to include it or not. I'd like to, I think this is productive in at least kind of airing kind of like the differences of opinion. We only have about 10, 15 minutes left. I'd like to kind of talk a little bit about what the police observer or when a police a law enforcement officer is on the scene. And one way to think about it, actually, sorry. is to first think about B being a law enforcement officer.
Right.
And so it's just A and B is a law enforcement officer, right? And I think, you know, this kind of goes to where we started, right? Like this exception for law enforcement officer conduct. And I think, you know, it's clear that, you know, again, the council, at least in the A3, where there was a lot of attention and focus, was saying, no. A to B, you know, if you got assault on police officer, right? You got assault liability if it rises to that vis-a-vis a law enforcement officer. But on A3, they were very clear, you know, the fighting words to a law enforcement officer, we're just looking at them right now, A to a law enforcement officer, no liability. Now again, one of the concerns we had, and maybe OAG or Dave thinks differently about this, but is there liability under A1 for, again, the situation where, let's say it's either fighting words or maybe it's gestures, right? Also under 3, but also kind of more clearly acting in a manner, and the law enforcement officer feels threatened, or again, maybe it's their police car that's parked right there, right? Nobody else is around. Maybe it's the law enforcement officer's property, right? And that conduct for A is, you know, they've got a stick, a baseball bat. I don't know what, you know, or maybe it's just that they're kicking, and like, you know, if the law enforcement officer on their own, you know, comes to the conclusion, a reasonable conclusion, let's say, that it's likely this person's behavior is about to result in criminal damage to property, you know, theft of harm to that person. Is there liability? Does that officer have enough to arrest? Our take was looking at the legislative history that, like, you know, there wasn't discussion of how that law enforcement officer in the A3, which there was a lot of attention to and some differences of opinion, how that applied in the A1 situation. So our take was that, it seems like, you know, while the council didn't seem to examine it, the same rationale that applied, that made an exception in A3 for law enforcement officers, should also apply in A1.
Okay, and this is where we disagree, because I think in A3, they're talking about retaliation.
Yeah.
And police officers should not retaliate ever. And I think that's what the city council was concerned about. Mm-hmm. They should be trained so they don't retaliate. They know what to do. They can hold their cool no matter what. That's a different situation from when they are the target of violence. Mm-hmm. Because then their training means nothing. If they're going to be hurt, they're going to be hurt. You can't be trained out of being hurt in the same way you can be trained not to retaliate. And that's why I don't agree with your analysis. And that's why I don't think CCE even recommended it, which is why you're drawing a conclusion out of a non-argument, because it was never proposed that police officers be exempted from the A1 and 2. It was only ever proposed from, it was A3. And so you're reading the lack of police officers in A1 back into it. But A1 and 2 don't list anybody.
You're right, Dave.
Right.
They don't list
their
anybody.
Their jobs are scary.
Yeah, that's it.
Go into the scary situation. Every time that you go into a scary situation, that the fact that they could have been scared is a crime?
No, that's your job.
So it's scary.
But that's not the way 1321 is written.
Why not? What does that mean? I'm acting in a way that makes the police officer is kind of scary. Yeah, go in there. That's your job.
So I don't understand. If A1 is meant to apply to an observer, I, as an officer stumbling onto the scene of a domestic, could reasonably fear for either of those people.
That's why I said I wasn't sure about the two-person situation.
Right, but
that's right.
That's the. I mean,
but
I think that's one of the.
The police officer might also be hurt.
Part and parcel.
No, but that's a different situation. No, I don't think that they have to continue to be in a situation. As she said before, disorderly conduct, breach of the public peace, is there so that law enforcement can intervene just before people get hurt. They don't have to wait until they get hurt in order to intervene. So in this situation, if the police officer is the target of the reasonable fear, there's nothing there that prevents the police officer from not making the arrest.
So when you have a situation where you have a protest and people have signs and they are shouting, and they are even, in fact, moving close. They're moving ahead. Let's say people start throwing very large rocks. It's your view in that situation, Laura, that the police can't be the target? That they have a reason to believe that they will be harmed, but
and they're the only ones? Yeah, that's my view. I don't understand. That's what their job is.
We're not
it's
example,
always
do you
scary.
Think the police officer has been assaulted in that case? What I want is I want an example where a police officer has not been assaulted and we still think that they were provoked enough to violence that it should be criminal. Because it's that
and
threading I want
exactly.
to find.
And which is why
but
I understand
not
exactly
that's
what
not
the counsel would have said when
A1
he said
is
in
not
connection with 3, because 3 gets a language and gestures. And I totally get that I'm going to be on the other end of that when I roll down my window and I say something that they want to agree. I get that is a concern, but that's about language. It's not about bodily injuries.
It's not even about this sort of
conduct. Wait, except we're asking police, so like our domestic violence situation. So there, it's in a park. Turns out they're rehearsing for a play. But when the police officer is walking up to it, it's reasonable that the police officer's like, this shit's scary. But that's the police officer's job to go up and say, hey, you two, cut it out. And they're like, no, we're rehearsing for a play. Sorry
and
about
I'm
that.
I'm with you there. Right, because that's a terribly dangerous situation, the domestic
could
violence.
Could be, but it turns out it's not. But police officers don't get to walk away. They have to walk up. That's
true.
What we want them to do. And
that
they might be afraid.
Different. And you're not going to be in the disorderly context anymore when that person on the scene in the domestic actually pulls out a knife or actually pulls out a gun. So that's why I was trying to stay out of that context, because that's clearly different. But when the rocks come out at the protest, so
right, except it's probably not. But then there's all these other people, right? You've necessarily created a situation where the police officer might be concerned. This is how I took the footnote to mean. The police officer might be concerned others might get harmed. But if the police officer is the only one who's like, shit, I might get hurt. Yeah, dude, that's your job. Like, I'm not saying it's a pleasant job.
So,
but
how
did
you
this
also in the context of the legislative history that accompanies, I now think we would have to, APO and resisting. And so there is, I think we have to agree in this jurisdiction, the legislature said, you know, these persons are going to take a little bumping and bruising. But is that the same as somebody lobbing a rock at you?
But sure, but that is an APO.
Yeah, so I think these are great questions, and I think again it goes to like the difference that we're talking about here is whatever slight bit of conduct that goes below an APO, an attempted APO, a simple assault type menace. These other charges that we have, right, are available. This is something, again, like this is very inchoate. This is like nobody was actually, you know, punched. It wasn't even an attempted assault. It wasn't even like, you know, a deliberate, you know, menacing gesture, right? Like, this is even less than that in all of these cases. And the question is, right, to what extent are law enforcement officers, for this
something less than this, the disorderly, are they clear? Now, it's just interesting, too. You know, all of this, the current statute, too, is limited to public places, right? And so that's another dynamic, right? If you wanted a police officer who's in an apartment,
that's why
the best, you know, different, right? You know, totally different. You don't have disorderly at all, but you still have this stuff, right? And this is still doing important work, right? Like really important work, and it goes really low. You know, it goes to like, you know, again, these are temp charges. Same thing. We're not going to get there today, but you know, accessory liability, right? You know, anytime your purpose, you know, you're encouraging somebody to throw a rock, to throw a punch, you have accessory liability in it. You know, so we've got this whole other regime of normal things that aren't constrained by public place, doesn't have this weird exceptions. Kind of all of this is about this even lower level stuff, right? It cuts even lower level. So, you know,
The problem with disorderly conduct as a crime, because the standard is so low, and what it's trying to prevent is kind of a perception of disorder. So that, if that's what it's trying to prevent, then situations like, you know, the people are engaged in some kind of karate exercise, but no one knows it. Well, it still looks disorderly. And, you know, in the situation that you described with the person who's making the weird gestures, I mean, you know, you see mentally ill people doing that all the time. But if they don't have they're not intentional or reckless, then they're not committing a crime, even though, again, the perception is still very disorderly. So at the end of the day, I think there's tension between a law that's about how things look and criminal law requirements for, you know, intentional wrongdoing. And then when it reaches that level of intentional wrongdoing, there's going to be another crime, so you really don't need disorderly conduct.
I think it's true that it is dealing with a small slice of conduct. And I think it's important to also think, like, look, so again, the A2, this kind of general incitement, again, you're purposely, you're encouraging somebody to commit a crime of any sort, you know, an assault, a throwing, you know, you've got separate liability for that under accessory for that crime. The A1, the kinds of things we've been talking about, where it's like this menacing type conduct, it's this kind of pre-attempted assault. The A3, the fighting words, is pretty distinct in the sense of like, there's nothing else that gets you that far, right? Like, there are no other, now again, you know, maybe there, in some fact patterns, it would be, you get some sort of accessory liability if somebody else is hearing it and you're wanting to stir something. The really just the pure fighting words example of goading somebody, it's not clear where that's really criminalized anywhere else. So if that goes, or again, to the extent that A1 also covers that, or I'm sorry, A1 kind of includes this type of conduct, were we to get rid of it altogether, we wouldn't have anything else, I don't think, in the DC code that criminalizes fighting words type situations, which does have this kind of underlying rationale of, look, this is about kind of stopping violence before it breaks out, you know, kind of like, and, you know, this is tough though, right? Like, there's a Supreme Court of somewhere in the South, I think it was South Carolina or maybe it was Alabama, you know, went all the way up to the state Supreme Court, and you know, guy just stands up in the middle of a church service and gives the finger to the minister, right? Was this a fighting words type provocation in this situation? You know, it was apparently, you know, it was, you know, this is tough stuff, right? You know, from the First Amendment angle, we want people, even on the fighting words, to be able to say outrageous things.
But where it is, you know, again, with a culpable mental state, you're reckless, you're even aware that what you're about to say can trigger violence, that's where most states begin to put jurisdictions, and there's a recognized exception to the First Amendment. So this is, it's a, such a fine line between turning from completely non-criminal, constitutionally protected, into something that must be criminalized. So we're at the end of our time. It's noon. It's a great questions. Comments are due before long. I'm happy to meet individually with folks. I think obviously, like, you know, look, the CCE took a couple of years to get up their recommendations before on this. And even then, there was a dissenting report. You know, like, there's just going to be a lot of disagreement on this. I think the clearer, if anybody has wants to add comments, again, as to, like, particular hypos, I think, like, and ensuring what you want covered, right? And what is the harm that this really needs to be targeting? That would be, in some sense, the most helpful comments, because we can try to craft language about that afterwards and make sure the abstract language applies the way we want. But if people can kind of be clearer, like, hey, this isn't sufficient. This shouldn't be criminal, period. Or, no, it potentially is. It's a fact-intensive exploration. But if you have a reckless mental state and a reasonable person who thinks this was likely to happen, that's legit, that would be helpful for us to be able to kind of craft the next version.
And if you could keep in mind the way that they stack as well,
so
that if you have recommendations on disorderly conduct, that necessarily affects
and
the
this other. And this is the way the, you know, a lot of jurisdictions for instance, the rioting statutes, right? It includes even more quasi-19th century, you know, it's violent and tumultuous conduct. And then it leaves to the common law to sort out what that means. We have very little, you know, case law here in the district. It's obviously been in the news a fair bit. Anyway, so the way our revised version structures it is it's an escalation of disorderly conduct in a group type situation. All right, leave it there for now. Again, happy to meet individually and talk with anybody, and look forward to your comments.
Super hard stuff.
Yeah. You can stop the recorder. Yeah.